Hello and welcome to the Learning College. I'm Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. And I will also post it on our new-ish social media site, akin to Twitter with the free speech left in, pieville.net. Pieville.net. Now, let's get down to it. We are in the middle of a people that shall dwell alone. Judaism is a group evolutionary strategy by Kevin MacDonald. We're on to chapter 6. Today we're going to do pages 210 to 226, so won't take too awful long. Should be loaded with great stuff, as all MacDonald writing is. Again, chapter 6. Starting. Cooperation, altruism, and the community control of group interests among Jews. So how they work together. Cooperation, altruism, looking out for each other. So altruism, but not in the general sense of looking out for someone who's not oneself, but only specific people. So Jews have very sharp lines of demarcation between Jews and non-Jews, whereas Christians and other groups and whites who are Christian generally do not. And the community control of group interests. So they're part of a community that is defining, here's what you are, here's what you need to do, and they have buy-in from the basic lowest level Jews or the average Jews, and this is how they proceed and make their way in the world, and it's worked out very well for them. A couple long block quotes to start it, more or less epigraphs. It must not be forgotten that although a high standard of morality gives but a slight or no advantage to each individual man and his children of the same tribe, yet an increase in the number of well-endowed men, an advancement in the standard of morality will certainly give an immense advantage to one tribe over another. A tribe that has more loyalty will do better than another tribe. A tribe including many members who, possessing in a high degree the spirit of patriotism, fidelity, obedience, courage, and sympathy, who are always ready to aid one another and to sacrifice themselves for the common good, would be victorious over most other tribes, and this would be natural selection. Guess who that is? That's Charles Darwin in 1871, page 500, The Descent of Man and Selection in Relation to Sex. And again, we face death on behalf of our laws with a courage which no other nation can equal. That's from Flavius Josephus against Appian, 2:234. He was a Jewish historian or fiction writer. Jews aren't real honest, so when you call someone a Jewish historian, it should always be remember that you're speaking tongue-in-cheek. And again, nowhere are the poor of that nation, i.e. Jews, seen abandoned without assistance to become a burthen to the country. And while those very men who regard as barbarians those who are strangers to the world and to its ways reluctantly give a trifling portion of their superfluity, their excess money, to the wretched victims of misery, a people whose name is held almost synonymous with ferocity would really think they should deserve the appellation if they could hesitate to share their moderate resources with unfortunate who surround them. So they're very generous to their own kind. Continuing, those who delight in affixing guilty intentions to praiseworthy actions will see nothing in this union but a dangerous association, but the sentimental observer will never hold back his just approbation, approval. An Appeal to the Justice of Kings and Nations, 1801, quoted in TAMA, T-A-M-A, 1807, 1971, 72, 73. MacDonald now. A principal conclusion of the discussion of Chapter 1 is that human group evolutionary strategies are conceptualized as, quote, experiments in living, well, let's try it this way, rather than the determinate outcome of natural selection acting on human populations, that humans can engineer how they act. They're not just some animal who's randomly being hit by lightning or randomly mating. They can create strategies to move through the world. Experiments in living, another way of thinking about it. It is therefore an empirical question something that determined by testing and looking around and observing, to determine the position of any putative strategy on several theoretically important independent dimensions. One of these theoretically important dimensions ranges from high levels of within-group altruism and submergence of individual interest to group interest, do you put the group ahead of yourself, at one extreme, to complete within-group selfishness at the other. Human group evolutionary strategies may be conceptualized as falling anywhere in this dimension, and the purpose of this chapter is to show that historical Judaism can be characterized as near the altruistic end of the dimension, although we shall see that in fact there have been important limits on altruism within historical Jewish communities. So, in theory, groups could almost not exist and people could be totally for themselves, or they could exist and be selfish within the group, or they could exist and be extremely altruistic within the group, and he's saying that Judaism is closer to that last. And we'll see how it's played out in history. And that's the subject of chapter 6 that we're in now. It would be difficult to overestimate the theoretical importance of altruism in evolutionary accounts of behavior. Altruism is deeply problematic because it implies that individuals engage in self-sacrificing behavior in the interests of others. Genes for altruism are therefore always selected against within groups, and many theorists have concluded that the evolution of altruism by natural selection is unlikely to be a major force in evolution. So if you look at humans purely as individuals, altruism is not going to make much sense. It has to be something people are choosing to do. To see themselves as part of a group is necessary for them to sacrifice themselves. Nevertheless, there is every reason to suppose that humans can develop altruistic groups that rely ultimately on human abilities to monitor and enforce group goals, to prevent defection, and to create ideological structures that rationalize group aims both to group members and to outsiders. McDonald, Wilson, and Sober. I'm not going to give the page names, just the people who wrote the papers sometimes. Thus, while it may be that, suffice it to say, everything he does is very well documented, so get the book if you want the actual end notes and stuff. Thus, while it may well be that group level evolution is relatively uncommon among animals due to their limited abilities to prevent cheating, human groups are able to regulate themselves via social controls so that theoretical possibilities regarding invasion by selfish types from surrounding human groups or from within can be eliminated or substantially reduced. Whatever the nature of the evolved machinery of the human mind, the thesis here is that human groups are able to impose altruism, cooperation, and acceptance of group goals on their members. A primary mechanism for the development of within-group altruism and the maximization of group rather than individual interest is proposed to be culturally invented community controls on individual behavior. Such controls can ensure that cheaters, i.e. non-cooperators, non-altruists, can be excluded from the group. Social controls also result in the reasonable expectation that the burdens of altruism will be fairly and impartially distributed within the community. However, social controls are not the only important mechanism in influencing altruism, cooperation, and acceptance of group goals among Jews. Evolutionary models imply that the threshold for within-group altruistic behavior is markedly lowered when the group members are biologically related. So the more related people are, the easier it is to set up these groups and have in-group control. And the data summarized in Chapter 2 indicate that indeed there is significant genetic commonality among even widely dispersed Jewish groups, combined with a genetic gradient between Jewish and Gentile populations. So he's already proved all that stuff, and we've heard that in earlier chapters. Moreover, these data indicate that, with the exception of non-Jewish Middle Eastern populations, all Jewish groups are more closely related to each other than any non-Jewish group. All Jewish groups are more closely related to each other than any non-Jewish group. So this group has been, regardless of whether they were kicked out or simply moved following the trail of opportunity, they've gone almost everywhere in the world, but they're all more related to each other wherever they are than they are to the surrounding host population and the lands in which they live. And yet you will see plenty of people trying to deny that and claim they're Khazars. The Khazar theory was set up by Arthur Koestler specifically to pseudo-scientifically destroy the idea that Jews were a race. Remember, Jews had always been treated as a religious problem, theological problem. And then Wilhelm Marr created the term anti-Semitism specifically. It's not what you would think if you didn't know it. He created it to make the distinction that he's opposed to the Jews racially. So the opposition of the Jews goes from theological is superseded by racial understanding of the Jews. And that's what today's Catholics like E. Michael Jones, Michael Hoffman try to reverse, to go back to the theological understanding. Oh, no, the problem with Jews isn't racial. The problem is they rejected Jesus. They only became Jews when they rejected Jesus. And then you start prodding that. Well, they just mean that in name. But then if you say that, but we get into a little different of an area I'm going to address in a non-audiobook setting. But this is the basic idea that Jews are very heavily related. MacDonald has demonstrated this. And that sets the basis for coming up with cultural ways of reinforcing, building upon the genetic substructure. You build, you know, the house of the culture on the solid foundation that we're all genetically related. Okay, what rules do we need to ensure that we stay a group and that we look out for each other and that we dominate other groups? And that's essentially what Judaism is. What it codified something that was already there. The genetic type existed, acted a certain way, and the Talmud formalized it, or at least reduced it to printed matter, or at least resisted scads of printing matter that already existed and put them in one, the same way they did with the Bible, brought it all together, edited it, pruned it, set it up, and finished it. But yet again, the Talmud is many, many, many volumes, so a lot of junk left in. I mean, Mencken read it and said, I read this, and no doubt you expect me to say that it's a wonderful, incredible, incredibly rich, dense work that greatly repays study, but alas, I must depart from such expectations. I found it to be basically garbage. One of the astutest minds that ever existed among whites and the best writer says the Talmud is garbage. A midden, a dump. Garbage dump for Jewish hostility toward others. And wacky, magical, Kabbalistic crap. So again, MacDonald is now using the basis that he's made for this next step. Okay, we proved that in earlier chapters that Jews are genetically related to themselves, not the surrounding host population, more closely related to each other than to any non-Jewish group. Thus, unlike universalist religions such as Christianity and Islam, Judaism over its history has fundamentally been a large kinship community in which the threshold for altruistic behavior toward group members was markedly lower than for altruistic behavior toward outgroup members. In addition, the degree of biological relatedness within the many small and scattered Jewish diaspora communities was undoubtedly much higher than the degree of biological relatedness characteristic of the Jewish population as a whole. This is especially so since these communities were often founded by a very few families, so that the actual level of biological relatedness within a particular Jewish communities may well have been very high indeed. Several authors, e.g. Chase and McCusick, Fracor, Morant, Kopeck, and Domanuska Sobchak, have emphasized the importance of founder effects and inbreeding in the population genetic history of the Jews, stemming ultimately from the fact that Jewish communities were often founded by a very few individuals who married endogamously, that is among their own, and consanguineously, sharing the same blood, including relatively high levels of uncle-niece and first-cousin marriage. Those are good things to keep in mind whenever you're talking about Jews to other people and saying, when they mock whites as being inbred. Well, this is the people where uncle, niece, and first cousin marriages were the rule for thousands of years. That's how they got that inbredness and that relatedness compared to the surrounding community. The point here is that this phenomenon would have also increased the level of biological relatedness within Jewish communities and lowered the threshold for altruism. Moreover, as indicated below, immigration from other Jewish communities was often strongly discouraged by the Jewish community itself. Such a policy would also have the effect of keeping the level of biological relatedness within the Jewish community relatively high. The relatively high level of biological relatedness both within and among Jewish communities is therefore expected to be a powerful force in facilitating altruism and the submergence of individual interests to those of the entire group. Putting the group ahead of yourself was made easier by the biological relatedness of the people. One for all for one. An important aspect of the following treatment will, therefore, be to provide evidence that the relationships of kinship were important to Jews themselves and figured prominently in Jewish economic activity, marriage decisions, and Jewish charity. Is this good for the Jews, what I'm about to do or pondering doing? From an evolutionary perspective, an important role of kinship in these activities is not expected to be restricted to Jews. However, its establishment as being an important principle among Jews is highly compatible with the thesis that Judaism is an altruistic group evolutionary strategy, where we look out for each other as a group. Another force expected to facilitate altruism and a group orientation among Jews derives from the typical role of Jews as a minority group in the midst of an often hostile Gentile society. A perennial problem for Jewish communities was to prevent individuals from engaging in behavior that would threaten the entire group. Thus, Katz, 1961a, notes that life in a hostile world required high levels of community control over group individual behavior. Quote, the danger threatening the group as a result of individual misconduct, since he's taken a stand for the rest of the group, operated as the most forceful check. Reiterated warnings and admonitions that were issued by public institutions and communal leaders stressed the fact that the life and death of the whole community rested in the hands of its individual members. The security of the Jewish community constituted a supreme and essential value. So they would police the behavior of anyone because, look, they already don't like us. If you do stuff that they don't like, you're going to bring down the whole community. As described more fully in Chapter 1, in situations of external threat, individual self-interest increasingly coincides with an interest in preserving the group. Indeed, external threat may well provide a cue that triggers evolved altruistic group-oriented psychological mechanisms. Moreover, because anti-Semitism has been virtually universal throughout Jewish history, altruism may come to verge on anticipated future reciprocity. Reflecting these realities, the Shulchan Aruch advised that, quote, one should also consider that the wheel of fortune is ever evolving and that he himself or his son or his grandson will eventually have to beg for charity, quoted in Zebrowski and Herzog, 1952. Such sentiments were common in the beginning of the ancient world. A high level of within-group charity may also have benefited the group strategy because it provided a safety net in traditional societies where economic success can be ephemeral for anyone. That ephemeral means appearing and then disappearing very quickly. The ephemerality of economic success is likely to be particularly salient to Jews, since they have often been subject to capricious seizures of property, expulsions, and confiscatory taxation. Interestingly, a medieval German synod enacted the law that required the entire Jewish community to pay when the king required a Jew to pay a capricious contribution, the only exception being in the case where the Jew was at fault. In other words, if a Jew is penalized capriciously because of his group membership, the entire group was expected to pay. Regulations such as this could be an important concomitant of a group strategy, since the risks of group membership were spread throughout the entire group and individuals who were subject to such capricious losses were less likely to defect because their individual losses were minimized, so spreading the risk across a group, like in a sort of insurance policy. If you're a Jew, then a hit on one Jew is a hit to you all, and a hit on, and that goes for you too, so you really are taken as a group rather than an individual. Hundert, or Hundert, notes the perception among Jews in Poland that wealth was ephemeral, and Katz notes that Jewish capital in traditional Poland was always precarious, since it was liable to expropriation by the authorities. Jews often specialized in obtaining forms of wealth that could be concealed, and that, quote, could be quickly switched from a point of danger to a point of resettlement. What would he mean by that? Well, he'd mean gold or diamonds and stuff. Today, Bitcoin. It's very portable. Wealth storage and portability are key. Moreover, in traditional societies, the economic basis of wealth among Gentiles has often been control of large areas of land, a relatively stable source of wealth. But among Jews, the economic basis of wealth has been much more likely to depend on trade and commerce, occupations which are more prone to economic fluctuations, and Jews were often prohibited from owning land. Economic success in trade and commerce would also be facilitated by a safety net, which would encourage Jews to take economic risks. Engaging in economically risky behavior has been noted by many writers as being characteristic of Jewish economic activity throughout history, citing Johnson and Mosse, Mosse, M-O-S-S-E. The diaspora situation itself also facilitated within-group cooperation among Jews. The diaspora resulted in Judaism being essentially a large kinship group in which internal divisions were de-emphasized, and in which the major division was between Jews and Gentiles rather than within the Jewish community. As discussed below, by shifting to a diaspora context, economic oppression of Jews by other Jews was minimized, and Judaism itself developed a relatively homogeneous set of interests. Economic cooperation within the community was maximized and economic exploitation minimized, but conflict and competition with the Gentile societies among whom they lived remained. A principal theme of this volume is that Judaism is a collectivist culture in the sense of triandis. Collectivist cultures and triandis, 1990, explicitly includes Judaism in this category. Collectivist cultures, and Judaism is included by T-R-I-A-N-D-I-S, place a much greater emphasis on the goals and needs of the in-group than on individual rights and interests. In-group norms and the duty to cooperate and submerge individual goals to the needs of the group are paramount. Collectivist cultures develop an, quote, unquestioned attachment to the in-group, including the, quote, perception that in-group norms are universally valid, a form of ethnocentrism, automatic obedience to in-group authorities, and willingness to fight and die for the in-group. These characteristics are usually associated with distrust of and unwillingness to cooperate with out-groups. Each of the in-group members is viewed as responsible for every other member, and relations with out-group members are, quote, distant, distrustful, and even hostile. In collectivist cultures, Judaism as a collectivist culture, morality is conceptualized as that which benefits the group, what's good for Jews. And aggression and exploitation of outgroups are acceptable. That's what you get with a collectivist group versus a universalist Christian ethic. These themes will be apparent in the following. You can see how a universalist group is going to be playing uphill against a collectivist small group. Besides, it's obvious, Jews are basically, if you think of them as they're thieves working together, and their thickness is Judaism. And, you know, the wider society doesn't like what they do, but it's not concentrated on them. It's supposing we are the universal, this is the universal, good and bad. And, well, they're not looking at it that way. They're looking at what's good for us and screw everybody else. In collectivist cultures, morality is conceptualized as that which benefits the group, and aggression and exploitation of outgroups are acceptable. These themes will be apparent in the following. Besides its obvious relevance to an evolutionary account of Judaism, it should be noted that within group altruism and submergence of individual interest to those of the group result in an extraordinarily powerful competitive advantage against individual strategies. So they are working as a team, and that's better than working as an individual, or has advantages over it. The competitive advantage of altruistic group strategies has always been obvious to evolutionists. The difficulty has been to conceptualize how altruistic groups could evolve as a result of natural selection, which would seem to treat with the individual. In the case of Judaism, however, the argument of this chapter will be that there has been an extraordinary confluence of forces that have resulted in relatively high levels of within-group cooperation and altruism, and a de-emphasis on individual interests. Now, a subsection. Economic cooperation and patronage among Jews. Epigraph from Flavius Josephus against Appian again. And for our duty at the sacrifices themselves, we ought in the first place to pray for the common welfare of all, and after that for our own, for we are made for fellowship one with another, and he who prefers the common good before what is peculiar to himself is above all acceptable to God. Flavius Josephus against Appian. In Chapter 7, I will discuss the importance of eugenics and the conscious development of an intellectual, entrepreneurial elite among Jews. However, this development must be seen within the wider context of Judaism as a national/ethnic strategy that emphasizes the rights and obligations of the entire community of Jews. This sense of community involvement and kin-based altruism can be seen as an aspect of the basic ideology of Judaism. Barron, 1952, notes that, quote, Judaism stresses the general aims of the Jewish people. To this day, Orthodox Jewish ethics has remained in its essence national rather than individual, and this accounts, incidentally, for the otherwise incomprehensible legal theorem of the common responsibility of all Jews for the deeds of each. The law, therefore, is an instrument of history to which the individual is subservient. And, quote, what really matters in the Jewish religion is not the immortality of the individual Jew, but that of the Jewish people. That's Barron. Quote, the nation's future and not that of the individual remained the decisive object. Barron again. Also Alon and Bickerman, Johnson and Moore. There was also a sense of corporate rather than individual merit, a sense that individuals inherited some merit from their illustrious ancestors. Bickerman. In the period following the destruction of the Second Temple, 70 AD, organized systems of social welfare and mutual assistance developed among Jews. These systems of social welfare had their antecedents in the early history of Israel as a kinship group in which the social ideal was to eliminate within-group exploitation. See also Chapter 8. Deuteronomy 15:1-18 clearly articulates the obligation to develop systems of welfare for poor Israelites. However, Israelite society often failed to live up to the ideal of a relatively egalitarian group in which within-group exploitation was minimized. See also Chapter 8. Israelite society was rife with class distinctions and the oppression of the poor during the period of national sovereignty, despite the disapproval of many prophets. Often the language used by the prophets reflects the language in the sections of Deuteronomy that emphasize the importance of social welfare among the Israelites, as when Ezekiel notes that among the sins of Israel, quote, the fatherless and the widow are wronged in you. Ezekiel 22:7. The Maccabean period also had its share of despots, and sharp social divisions persisted through the Second Commonwealth period. On to 219 now. Oppression within Jewish society would tend to lead to a lack of social solidarity among Jews and a loss of the fundamental kinship structure of Jewish society. However, when living as a minority in the diaspora, these trends were greatly lessened. Quote, before the battle for ethnic religious survival, the inner class struggle receded. We have to just survive as Jews. That matters more than any class differences between us. And a common economic front vis-a-vis the rest of the world developed. Barron. quote, "the Jewish minority community, placed on the defensive by a hostile world, could never develop those sharp internal conflicts which had characterized the Second Commonwealth. In the diaspora, even vast differences in wealth within the Jewish community would be less likely to be the result of poor Jews being exploited by wealthier Jews, since Jewish wealth would tend to primarily derive from economic transactions carried on with the Gentile community. Rather than the exploitation of poorer Jews by wealthier Jews, the emphasis was on cooperation and patronage within the Jewish community, while economic relationships with the Gentile community could be, using Katz's felicitous phrase, quote, purely instrumental." Well, they have no thought for the welfare or well-being or honest treatment of the goyim they are dealing with, purely what they can get out of them. That's what instrumental means. How do I use this instrument to get what I want? The instrument being the goyish population, being you, me, and our ancestors. Reflecting this, several writers have noted the high degree of commonality of interest and lack of class conflict in traditional Jewish diaspora societies. Weinrib writes of traditional Poland that, quote, "their communications and interests were similar, as were their fears and hopes, despite increasing socioeconomic stratification." And Israel, referring to European Jewish society in the 17th and 18th centuries, notes that, generally speaking, Jewish society conformed hardly at all to the Marxist notion of class differentiation and struggle. Almost always, the vertical ties which lent Jewish society its inner cohesion, commercial collaboration, and the patronage network implicit in Jewry's institutions, charities, and welfare system, were of much greater significance than any occasional friction between rich and poor. So they really are pretty much socially unified. And the pressure from the outside is holding them together and making them look at the outside rather than for divisions among themselves. The emphasis on minimizing within-group conflict is apparent in Jewish religious writing from the ancient period. The writers of the Talmud place a high value on class harmony among Jews, as well as a strong sense of collective economic responsibility. Baron Alon Neusner finds that a major theme of the Babylonian Talmud is the imposition of community norms on individual behavior. Oppression of Jews was sharply enjoined, and individual economic rights were sharply curtailed in the interest of communal and family solidarity. Reflecting these trends, there is excellent evidence that Jewish economic activity has historically been characterized by high levels of within-group economic cooperation and patronage. Jewish elites overwhelmingly tended to employ other Jews in their enterprises. In Chapter 5, the importance of highly placed courtiers in the general fortunes of the entire Jewish community was noted, and the relevant point here being that there was a strong tendency for these individuals to help their co-religionists. So yeah, we got our man at the court. He's going to watch out for our interests with the king. Baer, B-A-E-R, 1961, finds that the prosperity of Jewish communities in Spain, under both Spanish and Moorish rulers, Muslim, depended on the influence of Jewish courtiers. Quote, "in the courts of princes, Jews rose to positions of eminence and influence. The fate of Jewish communities was closely bound up with the political fortunes of these Jewish courtiers, whose personal rise or fall often carried with it the prosperity or ruin of their community." Similarly, Stillman, 1979, notes the role of Jewish courtiers in extending patronage to other Jews in a variety of Muslim societies, and the fact that, quote, "the fall of a Jewish courtier was a cause of deep anxiety for his brethren until the storm had passed." See also Patai and Aroni. During the early period of Mongol domination in Iraq, the Jew Sa'ad Daula filled his administration with, quote, "his brothers, kinsmen, and co-religionists." Fischel, 1937. His fall resulted in violence directed at the entire Jewish community. So they're really tied to the fortunes of a courtier, where you got a king and peasantry, essentially, even in Iraq, even in Spain. Places that different. There are numerous examples on page 221 now of high-placed Jewish courtiers or capitalists employing co-religionists in their economic activities. During the period of increasing dominance by the new Christians in 15th century Spain, those would be the Jewish fake converts, Roth notes that when Diego Arias Davila was appointed treasurer, other new Christians quickly achieved similar high positions as a result of his influence, nepotism. Roth also describes a general pattern in the New World in the 16th century in which the Sephardim controlled all imports and exports, with distribution throughout the country also performed by other Sephardim. Israel, 1985, shows that the court of Jews of 17th century Europe overwhelmingly employed their relatives and other Jews in their operations on behalf of various governments. So you have these governments, Goyish kings, but the network of people representing them is a bunch of nepotized Jews. So much so that I forget who it was, Henry Ford or someone, describing Versailles and the peace conference. It's just a bunch of Jews at the table representing all the Goyish nations. Jewish economic activity during the period is described as a complex interdependent pyramid in which all classes benefited from each other's activities. Quote, from court Jew to peddler, these divergent groupings penetrated and depended on each other economically. For example, when Samuel Oppenheimer obtained the right to settle in Vienna, he brought with him around 100 other Jewish families who were directly dependent on him. Oppenheimer also organized a vast network of co-religionist agents and suppliers. Quote, he secured for them charters and passes, contracts and monopolies, and obtained for them permission to settle in cities from which Jews had been excluded for centuries. Back then, there were, you know, in Germany and Central Europe, there were loads of principalities and protectorates and little king duchy areas, and so the Jew might have a different law facing him every 20 miles. Stern comments that this pattern occurred not only in Austria, but also throughout the German states. In Poland, Jews went into partnership as moneylenders, merchants, and toll farmers on a large scale, and the employees in these business enterprises and in toll and tax farming were Jews over whom the entire entrepreneur often exercised judicial rights. They bought the right to farm these stupid goyim and make them pay tolls and stuff. They bought that from the nobles who owned the estates. That was a whole system in Poland where they really waxed rich and large in number. Indeed, Katz notes that there was an entire Jewish working class among the 16th to 18th century Ashkenazim who, quote, engaged in production, transport, and the management of enterprises financed by Jewish capitalists. Like the dependents of Jewish courtiers, this Jewish working class was entirely dependent on the success of the capitalist, and the capitalist, in turn, was absolutely dependent for his position on his being useful to the Gentile authorities. Weinrib notes that solidarity and contacts played a considerable role in economic activity. The strength and structure of an enterprise, firm, or partnership were conditioned by group solidarity. This basic pattern continued into the 19th and 20th centuries. Lindemann, 1991, describes wealthy Jewish capitalists employing other Jews in 19th century Russia, and Sachar, S-A-C-H-A-R, and Liebman find a similar pattern in the United States in the early 20th century. Indeed, Howe, 1976, describes a sort of self-contained economic world of immigrant Jews in the early 20th century in which the vast majority of economic transactions for products and services were carried on with other Jews. Kotkin, 1993, describes the continuing importance of what one might call, quote, tribal economics among far-flung Jewish groups in the contemporary world. So they're dealing with each other. They're nepotistic, and they just don't like dealing with outsiders because it doesn't advantage them, except to rook them and to profit off them. But they're working for the good of themselves and their group above all. Beginning in the ancient world, Jews also tended to form protective trade associations or guilds with other Jews. Baron Neumann describes numerous merchant and artisan guilds among the Jews of pre-expulsion Spain. Groups of, that's 1492 when they were expelled, like the Moors. Groups of Jewish traders and craftsmen organized, quote, for purposes of self-defense and for regulating the industries in which they were engaged, and there were intense bitter rivalries with Christian guilds in the municipalities. As indicated in Chapter 5, competition between guilds organized around ethnicity continued even after the forced conversions of 1391, and even though the new Christian guilds were nominally Christian. Similarly, Bernadette, or Bernardette, B-E-N-A-R-D-E-T-E, 1953, Bernardette cites a 19th century observer of Sephardic Jews in Salonika, quote, who was shocked to learn that the solidarity among them is so great that in the business world, trade union practices prevailed. There was, quote, a religious significance attached to the protection of one's livelihood. In addition, Jews formed Jewish unions and other types of Jewish socialist labor movements in which the entire membership was Jewish, e.g. the Polish and Russian Bunds, and in the United States, the Union of Hebrew Trades and the Jewish Socialist Federation. This is the matrix and milieu out of which the funding came for the people who took over the Soviet Union, the Jewish radicals, high capital and low street thugs, thuggery. These specifically Jewish labor movements, see, they did piece work on sewing machines, and they could put it down and do communist strikes and communist agitation, then go right back to it. It's a very typical Lower East New York scene when you had the anarchists and communists flourishing in the U.S. and New York as Jewish immigration picked up after 1880. These specifically Jewish labor movements, which typically combined socialism with a strong sense of Jewish cultural separatism, often conflicted with the internationalist, assimilationist tendencies of the wider socialist movement, and ultimately with a communist government in the Soviet Union. Indeed, Levin, 1977, describes the Jewish labor movement in the United States as a sort of, quote, sub-nation in which, quote, Jewish laborers work for Jewish employers, and the class conflicts between them were carried on in a Jewish ethnic culture. Interestingly, the class conflict appears to have been much muted because the employers were also Jewish. Because the Jewish socialist leaders retained strong ties to the Jewish community, they were less hostile toward the Jewish bourgeoisie and often obtained charity for Jewish workers from Jewish capitalists. Quote, assistance and common interests, especially combating anti-Semitism and relationships of this kind, contributed to the muting of the socialist union leaders' class hostilities. They also significantly diminished their intercommunal class hostility and helped to make these socialists more broadly Jewish in their orientation. On the other hand, Liebman suggests that the Jewish union leaders became more conciliatory toward management when the ethnic composition of the unions changed toward being predominantly Gentile. Moreover, union management relations became a more formal rather than a communal affair when the unions became predominantly Gentile. The suggestion is that ethnicity had a powerful effect on all of these relationships. This powerful communal sense can also be seen in immigration patterns. Aid was forthcoming not just from family members, but also from other Jews emigrating from the same town or region. Jewish employers often recruited preferentially from particular regions, with the result that, quote, families, neighborhoods, and towns would be transported almost intact and set down again in tenement, block, or small neighborhood in a city in the United States. Liebman, 1979. Once in the United States, Jews developed extensive mutual aid societies, including the Landsmannschaft societies, based on kinship ties, and or a common place of residence in Europe. Describing the function of the Landsmannschaft, Wirth, 1956, notes that a stranger who is able to call himself a Landsmann, not only loosens like a paisano, or except in German, not only loosens the purse strings of the first individual he meets, but also has access to his home. Not only do the Landsleute belong to the same synagogue, but as a rule they engage in similar vocations, become partners in business, live in the same neighborhood, and intermarry within their own group. A Landsmannschaft has its own patriarchal leaders, its lodges and mutual aid societies, and celebrations and festivities. Communication was also an element of Jewish economic cooperation. Katz, 1961, emphasizes the fact that Jewish economic unity in the face of dispersion was important for its economic success. Quote, "The possibility of constant communication with people living in other countries with whom there existed a kinship of language and culture gave an economic advantage to the Jews who were scattered over so many lands." For example, writing of the court Jews during the period from 1640 to 1740 in Europe, Stern, in 1950, notes that, quote, "the Jew seemed to be better qualified for the position of war commissary than the Christian." That's actually what dragged down Benedict Arnold, dealing with a Jew war commissary of that type. He was in close contact with his co-religionists throughout Europe, so they know how to source, get better sources and cheaper sources because they're working together. They can basically outdo the Christians operating as individuals. And the thing is, when you get an advantage over time, it grows stronger, not weaker. You know more. You have more connections. You're more able to be good at it. So it's not just that it stays the same. It gets better, actually. Stern notes that, quote, "the Jew seemed to be better qualified for the position of war commissary than the Christian. He was in close contact with his co-religionists throughout Europe. He was therefore able to maintain agents and correspondents in all countries and could receive through them the necessary goods and important news." Stern, 1950, also notes that Jews were also ideally suited to function as financial agents to Gentile princes because of their contacts with foreign banking firms. So pretty much if you want something or money or something in a foreign land, you've got to work through Jews. They're the ones who know what they're doing, and they've been in position a long time. So how much more dangerous to give them actual political power, and they become used to running the governments outright, as they do in the U.S. now. And they get an advantage, they have a culture, they have the context, they have the history, and you're going to beat them from nothing. From all you have is you getting to pull the stupid lever once every 4 years, you see? The advantage and the distance grows larger over time. Ties of language were especially advantageous since Jews from widely dispersed areas could communicate easily with each other, say Yiddish or Hebrew or something. Shaw also describes a system of bills of exchange that were honored by other Jewish traders and bankers and that gave Jewish traders a competitive advantage over Christian and Muslim traders. Such ties continued well into the modern era. Mossad, writing of the period from 1820 to 1935 in Germany, notes that, quote, "Jewish commercial activities outside Germany were facilitated by a strong sense of Jewish solidarity and mutual trust, often reinforced by kinship ties. Later, with a weakening of the ties of social solidarity based on traditional Jewish observance, Jewish contacts across national frontiers persisted on the basis of common networks of acquaintance, of apprenticeships, of long-standing commercial relations, occasionally reinforced by kinship ties. These commercial networks were much more extensive than those typically available to Gentiles." What have I said? Jews are the only ones with a network. No one else really has a true extensive network like they do. There were other benefits as well. Sorkin notes that a function of one of the many voluntary Jewish associations that sprang up in Germany in the 19th century was to provide loans to Jewish businessmen. Moreover, Mossi finds that a large network of lesser Jewish bankers developed under the aegis of the Rothschilds. Mossi also provides several examples of Jewish banks in which the partners and directors tended to be Jewish, even when there were no familial connections. And Jewish entrepreneurs in a wide range of industries often were financed by banking firms owned by Jews. Moss, 1987. Moreover, Jews tended to do business with other Jews throughout this period, quote, "almost certainly beyond the call of purely economic necessity." Mossi, 1987. Finally, last page for today. Finally, in the era of joint stock companies after 1900, a, quote, "Jewish sector of the German economy developed, characterized by interlocking directorships among commercial and industrial enterprises and their financial institutions. In a statement which would also serve as a rough summary of Jewish economic behavior throughout history, Mossi notes that one theory of the remarkable Jewish economic success, particularly in the banking industry in Germany throughout the period from 1820 to 1935, was based on, in a long block quote to close this section and today's taping, Jewish economic success in banking in Germany from 1820 to 1935 was, quote, an internal dynamic of dynasty formation, personal relations, kinship ties, socialization processes, and in general the operation of a variety of informal networks. At least until mid-19th century, Jews tended to transact business mainly with fellow Jews, in part because Jewish ritual laws impeded, if they did not completely inhibit, between Jew and Gentile, the social intercourse almost inseparable from sustained business relations. Whether through kinship ties, greater confidence and sympathy, feelings of solidarity, or recommendations, there would be a marked tendency for Jews to employ fellow Jews in positions of trust as men having prokura, P-R-O-K-U-R-A, and eventually to raise them to a partnership. Close and harmonious business relationships, reinforced by personal friendship, the friendship of families, and common leisure pursuits, would, not infrequently, contain also an element of common Jewishness. So their networking brings them economic success, and notably, maybe even most notably, maybe second only to serving the kings, but related to that, in the banking sector. This is how they gain advantage. Anyway, I've been Alex Linder reading to you out of A People That Shall Dwell Alone, Judaism as a Group Evolutionary Strategy, and we did Chapter 6, pages 210 to 226 today. You can find this and everything we do at vnnforum.com. I also post it now at pyphil.net, our social media in the manner of Jack Dorsey's and Andrew Torba's. Anyway, thanks for being with me. I'll be back with you again real soon.